We're just about to start the class. And we'll continue from where we were last week. Audio test, make sure everybody's picking up the audio. So when you hear the audio stream, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen. Okay, Laura, thanks. We're just going to call
in. Thank you for using ConflictTown.com. Please enter your conference ID, followed by the pound sign. If you are the moderator, please press 1. Otherwise, please enter the moderator PIN number, followed by the pound sign.
All right, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Rabbi.
How you doing today? All right, Doug, Cal, Jim, Josh, Francesca, let me know if everybody's on. We should start.
Yeah.
Cal and Doug are here.
Present. Rivka, present.
And Josh already relocated to Arizona, right?
Yeah.
Very good. Okay. Francesca, you were able to get the previous audio file?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, sure. Okay, and Mike is on with us, and Laura and Rachel. So they're online. And we've got the audio going well. Good to see you, Mike, Laura, Rachel. All right, so let's start. So we're going to continue in the Ibn Ezra, which is on Kohelis 7:3. And just to recap the what he said up to this point, so he said that the three parts of the human soul, some people refer to as three different souls, but for the most part we'll refer to them as faculties or forces. And he explained that, again, you have the lusts, you have the ego, and you have the intelligence. And the ego is what is couched between, sandwiched between the other two. So the person who makes the decisions is referred to as the ego. And he has to decide if he's going to be following his emotions or he's going to be following the intelligence. So he said at the beginning, at the outset of a person's existence, he says this was, and if you just put on your the mute buttons, we're just getting some feedback. So turn on your mute button unless there's questions come up. Okay.
Rabbi, there's a little bit of a problem with the sound. It keeps going lower and higher.
Okay, so I have the phone right next to the mic, so I'm right next to the phone too. So.
Okay.
But if you turn on your mute. Turn on your mute button, and you'll see you'll have a constant flow of sound.
Yeah, I put the mute on when I stop speaking. I'll try that again.
Okay.
Okay.
That should help. Okay. So let's read. So, let's just see where we'll start from. Okay, just to read the last few sentences.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, go ahead.
The part of you that decides, you're saying it's the ego?
Yes, that's what we're referring to as the ego, the person themselves, the sense of the self. When I think about myself right now and I am reflecting on myself, that part of me that can do that is not the instinctual drives. Instinctual drives don't have the perceptive quality. All the instincts can do is seek satisfaction. They don't have the ability to reflect. You know, that's just not the nature of the apparatus. Just like a heart cannot intake oxygen through air. That's the job of the lungs. And the lungs cannot pump blood. That's just not what they do. Factually. So factually, the ego is the part that is perceiving both pulls of the intelligence and also of the emotions. So we're referring to that as the ego, the self, the I. When a person says, I am, whatever. So the I of the person, that's what we're referring to. Okay. So, and he says, so let's just repeat the last line because it's important. He says, Sanjigon also refers to the three parts, and we showed that Freud has the same division. And he says as follows, and it's known that when the instincts are overpowering a person, so the intelligence will weaken, and there will be no power in the intelligence to stand before the instincts. And we said, why? Because Ibn Ezra says, on account of the fact that there is a body. So what that we said that meant, and he says also, and all of the other inclinations strengthen it. So let me see what Rachel's writing. No challenges to ascend to the self. We're not going by that. You need to have dissension for ascension. Again, we'll follow the words of Ibn Ezra, and let's just see exactly what he tells us without, you know, putting anything on top of it. Okay. If I don't look on screen and answer the questions, it's only because I'm reading the Ibn Ezra. So if it takes me time to see any notes on screen, you'll understand, please, why. Okay, so he says that the instincts overtake the person, so the intelligence has no ability to really stand before it. Why? Because of the body. That means to say that and Jim mentioned last week, that the fact that the person has a body, that gives them a sense of reality more than intelligence, which is wrong. But that's just the way a person is at the outset, that they give more reality to the physical, to the sensations. And if there's a strong pull on something, so a person is going to be more inclined to follow that just because he senses the visual and the audible and the drives that a person wants to satisfy, and the fact that he looks at himself as a body. This is like an argument that's more real than anything else, because that's what he sees. The person is more in tune to the senses, and therefore will elevate the body and the physical existence over the intellectual existence. And we said, of course, that can't be so, because the world of the metaphysics is, I mean, God's laws, that's what governs the world. So that is more real. That's determining what the physical world should be. So the truth, the world of wisdom is more real than the physical, because the physical is only an expression of those laws. Okay. So he says that the soul, the intelligence will become weak if the instincts overpower a person, then you won't be able to stand before it because of the overestimation that people give to the body. And all the other instincts are helping it as well. And we said that also means that when you excite one instinct, the other ones also do. The other instincts also get dragged along. And I don't know if we cited it, but our Chagall explained how when they made the golden calf, they also made a party too. That means that once they were giving into the instinctual on the religious plane, because the instinctual has many planes that it works on. So once they gave an answer, then it spilled over to the other areas and instincts they were involved in other type of physical enjoyments, satisfying other urges. Okay. Let's go further now. And he says, and therefore those who people who involve themselves in eating and drinking will never become wise. So now you understand what he means, because if a person is going to aggravate the other drives, eating and drinking, so then he's going to remove his energies from being involved in intelligence. Now he goes further. I think this is the last sentence that we read from last week. But when the soul teams together with the ego, then you could be successful over your instincts. Okay? That means to say that at the outset, the person is more involved in the instincts. A child, and it's growing, and so on. But then, and a child doesn't care about ego. That is not something which a five-year-old concerns himself with. He sees a toy, he grabs it, it's mine, I don't care that the other kid is playing with it. And he has no concern how he looks in front of the other children. That's just not part of the person that's been developed yet. So it just is not present. But when a person gets older, then the ego starts to develop. And then the person values that more than being very base and just going after, base instincts. Because then, what are my friends going to say about me? Right? And teenagers have this, in a preponderance. That's when the whole sense of self and esteem is starting to emerge. So it's a very conflicting time for a teen. So Ibn Ezra says that when the ego starts to develop, so then a person could do is team together his intelligence with the sense of ego, and that is how we can overcome the instincts. And that's true, because a person wants to have power or wants to have esteem or honor, so what he'll do is use intelligence to get there. But now what happens is, then Ibn Ezra says, then the eyes are opened up a bit. The eyes of the soul are now first opened up. Now he's not going after just base instincts anymore. But with the desire for esteem and honor, the person will use intelligence and engage it. He'll see that it's a great tool to get what he wants in terms of power or fame or prestige. And then what happens is the soul's eyes start perceiving a little bit of wisdom, but not of the greatest level of wisdom. And he says, therefore, the soul cannot know greater levels of wisdom. Why? Because the power of the ego is still at play. And that's anchoring the soul, the intelligence, from really being involved in wisdom to the highest degree. Because the person is still seeking, as his real goal is to have power, to rule over others. So he can't really intensify the powers of the intellect. But he says that this desire for power, this is what gives birth to anger. And he says, this is the explanation of our verse. That better is anger than just laughter. Meaning better is it that the person is involved in a certain frustration, which comes from the ego. Meaning if he's involved in the ego, that means he's removing himself from the instincts, from the laughter. So that's a good first step. So that's what he means by this verse, that better. This is not the highest level, of course, of man, but it is better because it's not the most base level. Now at least the person's evolved in something which is removed from the instincts, something a little bit higher up. And what does he see the reason is for? And he says, the matter is, and he says, kibaroa panam yitavle, that with frustration, the heart is improved. And the heart, and he says, what is that frustration? He says, this is like anxiety the person has, worries. And he says, the lave, the heart, this is a reference to the intelligence. Okay, so if we look at our verse, The verse reads, better is anger than laughter, because anger is now where the person didn't get what he wanted in an ego manner. Anger is not the result of a frustrated lust. That's just frustration. Anger is when the self feels that it didn't achieve what it wanted, or it doesn't want to tolerate something. I don't have to tolerate this. The ego is involved when anger is there. But he says that's why it's better than just laughter, because at least something higher than the base instincts is being engaged. And then he says, also in a verse, because with frustration, the heart is improved. So what does he mean now? That with frustration, the heart is improved. So when he's going after arrogance, when he's going after ego to have certain accomplishments for himself in the ego, so we said that he has to engage the intelligence. And that's what it means that the heart is improved. Now the heart is brought into the picture. So now you should see how the verse works. Let me just stop here and make sure it's clear for everybody.
Rabbi?
Yes, Doug, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
So maybe you're going to get there, but one of the things that troubles me here is that it says the heart is improved. So I assume it's going to mean that the anger that is brought about leads to an improvement of the mind or the soul or the character. And the concern I would have with that is, do we really see that actually happens?
Well,
in the vast majority of cases.
What I think he means is that when there is anger, which is now indicative of the presence of ego, so that also drags with it the fact that the person had to harness his intelligence a bit in order to try to achieve that state of ego. So that's what I think he means, that even when he has frustration, but it's still good, because now the intelligence was activated. That's what I believe it means, that the heart has improved, that the intelligence has been activated. Whereas before this, a person is just purely involved in lusts, so then the intelligence has not been activated.
Right. But I guess the question I'm asking is, I mean, I can see where it gives the opportunity for improvement. But if we look around at, you know, a random 1,000 people who get angry.
Well, that anger is better than just being indulging in lusts, is what it's saying. Because the anger is indicative of the ego trying to satisfy itself. But that can only be done through a certain intelligent approach. A person can't get up.
Okay.
You know, a person can't get up in the middle of a dinner when somebody else is getting honored and grab the mic, run up to the stage, grab the mic and say, I should really be honored for X, Y, and Z. That would just be too base for a person to do. That's not how the ego would operate. That would be something which a person would really be shooting himself in the foot. So my understanding is that he would have to harness some intelligence in order to, you know, get the ego that he's looking for. And that's where the intelligence is being improved, meaning improved in the manner that is now being activated when it was dormant prior to this.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Okay. And then he says further, and after that the soul can overcome the instincts through the assistance of the ego, which is what we just talked about, then the soul needs to be involved in wisdom that it can strengthen itself until it succeeds over the ego also. So we just succeeded over the instincts by going after ego satisfactions as opposed to sensual satisfactions. But then he says the soul has to make one more step, and it has to be involved in wisdom, to be immersed in wisdom. And it should strengthen it until it now becomes superior over the ego, and the ego is now placed into the hands of the soul. So he says that's the next step, because once the at least the intelligence has been activated as a tool for ego, at least now it's active. Now, while the intelligence is active, now the next step in life is to indulge in more intelligence until you start seeing that that's really what's going to be most enjoyable, more than the ego. So you have to immerse yourself in the intelligence now that it's been awakened. Let it start perceiving more and more wisdom until a person gets to the point where he doesn't look at himself as being the objective. He doesn't need to be on that pedestal. Now, he's very happy to be anonymous and to be purely involved in observing God. My friend this week told me that when it talks about in the Uz Yashir, the song that the Jews sang after God had drowned the Egyptians at the Reed Sea. So they said, one of the phrases was, God is greatly exalted. Go, oh, God. Which was greatly exalted. And he was telling me that Unkelus says in that verse that the gayest delay, meaning that pride is God alone, not man. Meaning the right perspective is when man is not, there's nothing in the world, in man's perspective, that deserves any type of honor except God. Meaning to say man should not be a focal point. It's really, you know, man is puny. He's nothing. So that should be the point. That's where a person can, you know, he can reach that level. If he can break away from ego. But that's a very powerful thing. And people are very conservative from the time that it bites them, at, you know, when they become teenagers and they're concerned about how they're being viewed. Most people just can't let go of that. And they forfeit the life where they can be independent and they could care less about public opinion because they want to spend their lives in wisdom and really making use of the one life they have for the only thing which is really going to give them true happiness and just enjoyment in the pursuit of wisdom. So you see, that's the last step that he says over here that a person has to do. Is once he's got the soul is active, even though it's only as a means right now for the ego, keep it active, but now involve yourself in more wisdom until it strengthens itself and it overpowers the ruach, and it overpowers the ego, and now it places the ego in its own hands. That the soul is now making all the decisions. Beforehand, the ego is driving the person, and he just utilized the soul. He utilized the intelligence. But a person can get to the point where their values change if they are involved in wisdom. And he says, this is the explanation of another verse in Kabbalah, where he says, don't be excited by your soul to become angry. Meaning to say, it's not the soul, the ego. Don't be excited in your arrogance to become angry. Meaning, you should be a person that the arrogance is now under the hand of the soul. So you see, that's what he's quoting verses from Kohelis, that's what Ibn Ezra is doing, in order to show how his theory is expressed in numerous cases. He also says another verse, for anger is in the bosom of the fools, that's where it rests, and it's with them forever, and it does not remove from them. But in a wise man, you will not find anger, except in its proper time and only for a need. And Maimonides actually says a real wise person never gets angry, but he says in another place, the person has to show it. I'm not sure it was a Rambam or a Gemara, but he says at certain times the person has to show, make a display of anger. Not that he is angry, but that is an effective way to teach the student or the child to just display some anger with something, because that's the language that the child has at that point, or the student has. They're still more impressed by emotional expressions than an intellectual idea. So it's important to know when to express it, but to feel anger, never. Anger and arrogance are the two things that the Maimonides says you never get involved in.
Can I ask something? I hope it's not too off track.
Go right ahead.
But I was wondering, like, you know, in this process, like, you know, you have children where you see that, you see them, they're, like, when they're very, very young, you see them being bashful, you know. And then they're, you know, then they have their, you know, young child can still, you know, is concerned, like, even at 6 years old, he's concerned about his clothes and what people will think. So at what point in time do you introduce it, like, intelligence, for example, like Michelet? I don't know if, you know, there's, like, really a formula. And then also, like, how do those things, like bashfulness, for example, how does that relate to the ego?
I think a child is only bashful. I don't think it's really bashful. I think it's fear that it's not the parent. I see this plenty of times that the, you know, a child with his brothers and his sisters, he's, you know, very excited and plays and demands things. There's no, the child's not bashful. Hey, that's my toy. They're completely, you know, rooted in mine and just pleasure seekers. And
no, and I'm sure it was like no more than a year and a half. Somebody was like laughing at him because he did something cute, and then he just kind of, he kind of smiled and he put his head kind of down, like he was, he really looked like he was embarrassed. He was,
well, that was because,
like, smiling about it, you know? It was really weird, like at that age, but it was, yeah, it was bashfulness.
I don't think it was bashfulness. With the person that was laughing, did he know the person well?
No, it was a stranger. Right. And he was saying, he was like, I don't know, making some sort of noise in the supermarket, and then somebody was like laughing at him. And he just, like, put his head, and also him, when he was, like, just 5 years old, he was very conscious of what people thought of him, like what he wore and what, you know. I don't know if that's unusual. Maybe that's, like, unusual.
Well, I mean, people have different personalities. It's not a good and it's not a bad. So there could be, maybe he had a greater measure of that, of concern about others that, you know, maybe, and also different emotions come out at different ages for different children. So there's no real set thing. The thing which is set is that we all have the same number of emotions. Everybody has hatred. Everybody has love. The question is, when is that expressed? When does it start getting expressed? How intense is it? How often is it? So there's many parameters to any given emotion. So there's going to be a very large range. So I guess what we have to do is, you know, speak in the general. But there's going to be, you know, specific cases, of course. But in general, once the child knows somebody, so they're not going to have the same reaction to somebody laughing at them that they don't know, because there's going to be a comfort level, and the concern isn't really there so much. And again, you know, you have to look at the individual cases. But I would say in general that the concern is really not there that young. The concern is,
and I guess my second question is, when, how do you know when the person is ready for the intelligence? Because I've been told that, like, too early can really do damage to a person, but then you see that they have the ego and the concern coming out at an early age.
Yeah, again, that's going to be different ages to it. I mean, in general, they didn't bring kids to school until they were 5 or 6. So that was because, I guess, they still need to have the stability of the parent or the mother specifically, and let them play, let them enjoy, because they're still developing. And a person has to be, they talked about it, you know, there were different kids had different approaches. So what do you do with the kids that didn't learn? So it's discussed. So you have to assess every child individually, of course. My friend Rabbi Rosenthal would often quote the statement, you know, teach a child in accordance with his nature. Every child is different. I don't know about the idea that if you introduce, I mean, if a child is able to grasp an idea, I mean, you have to really, that's a level already. You'd think that that would be like, you know, like 10 years old. I mean, a child is 5, you can say something, it doesn't make sense to me. You know, that's, it's going to rule over. Even if they understand something, the emotion is still going to be fighting it. Then you may put them in conflict, like you just said, it may be damaging. So, I would wait. There's no rush. You know, people want to get the kids really advanced, and they're concerned about it, but a lot of times they hurt the kid. I think the kid also will give signs. They'll ask questions. You'll see how they respond to certain things. And that's a great opportunity. Like, you know, a kid is walking, all of a sudden he asks a question. hey, you know, how come the clouds don't fall to the ground? Now he's ready. Now you see, he just made a step. Up to that point in life, he didn't care that clouds were flying in the sky and everything else dropped to the ground when he let go of it. So you'll see, you know, there'll be certain points, too, I believe, that will be indicators as to when he's ready for something.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Rabbi, could I say something to Naomi?
Yeah.
Yeah, Naomi, I just wanted to just mention something that I had the same question when I had my children very young, and my father, Zichrono Bracha, he told me very simply, he says, just keep in mind that every child is different. It's like the fingers of your hand. The fingers of your hand is the hand is the mother. Each child is, each finger is like another child. But each finger, if you look at it, has a different purpose, has a different strength. You can't expect the children all to be the same. And then you have to keep in mind also that, I know I was afraid of this too, how come this child reacted in a bashful way? Is he always going to be bashful? But it was because he had never experienced it before. He never saw somebody, you know, give him some accolades for something that he had done. It was the first time. And then when it happened the second or the third time, it was cute. He handled this differently. He liked the idea that he was being applauded in a sense. And I think it's like the rabbi said, it stems from a sense of fear. They don't know. They don't know. And then we become, as mothers, we become a little bit afraid because we want the children to be well and happy, and we want to teach them so that they have everything that they're supposed to have. But we don't know what they're able to absorb. And sometimes we have to stand back and watch, like we're watching a show, the children are on stage. We have to sort of identify what each one is capable of. It's fascinating. And when you see them grow up, when you have one, you said it was 5 or 6 now, the difference when he was 2 or 3, the difference in his personality, they are more open. And if they are of the bashful and sweet, soft nature, that nature stays with them in a very gentle way. But it's part of their personality, which is a beautiful thing. But look at it and, identify it. Don't be afraid of it. They'll learn as they're able to learn, all in their own way.
Yeah. Thanks, yeah. Sorry. That makes sense.
Okay. All right, so let's take the next statement. So now we're moving up to new ground now in Ibn Ezra. So he says further. And again, he's going to keep on quoting new verses now. Once he's laid down his theory, now he's going to show support through a number of verses in Qoheles. Most of them we've done, I think. Okay, and he says, and now the matter of, quote, with increased wisdom comes increased anger. So now, how do we explain that verse? Because now that we understand the dynamics of the three parts of the person, how can we understand these verses? Do you think that with increased wisdom is increased happiness? How could you have a verse that says with increased wisdom there's increased anger? And he says this is also similar to the matter where he says, do not become overly wise. Because with the increase of wisdom, again, you will increase your anger. But what is the anger going to be on? On the futility of the world. And on people. Meaning to say that the person becomes very wise, he starts to examine things, and he starts to see how what typical people can get enjoyment from, gatherings together with the talking, just chit-chat and this and that, and buying this new car or that. So a person who's wise will see through all this, and he says, this is foolish. This doesn't really give me any satisfaction. So what he means to say is that the person will become very wise. There'll be anger at things which normally gave him satisfaction. And then he'll leave inhabited areas and just isolate himself. Therefore, he says, what's good for a person? That he should weigh all matters with a very just scale and give a portion to each one of the three souls in its proper time. So that means to say that if a person is going to constantly be applying his wisdom in every single area, so when he goes to a wedding, it's like there's a Rashi, there's a comment. So Rashi quotes two people that were talking. A man was making a big celebration for his son. He got married or so on, or he had a child. And a friend says to him, why are you being so happy? Don't you know that eventually your son is going to die at a certain age? So the person who made the statement was what we would call the person who was too wise. So the first one said back, and he says, listen, at the time of happiness, I'm going to be happy. At the time of sadness, I'll be sad, which is what Ibn Ezra's solution is that don't try to be overly wise means that there are moments in life which are enjoyable, and the person should rejoice in them, and he should not be the type of person where he's just morbid, and he's walking around with, he's forcing himself to deal with things before they've even happened. I mean, it says openly that God hid the day of death for man, that he shouldn't have that type of a state. So when he says that with the increase of wisdom is the increase of anger, that is a negative thing. If a person is using his wisdom improperly, a person should use the wisdom in all the parts of himself, and he should weigh it out. When should this be used? When should it not be used? But everything should be under the control of the intellect. And through the intellect, the person will make the decisions. Okay, so this is important, because you think that wisdom unconditionally is to be applied. But it seems to be what he's saying here, no? Why should you be too wise? Because with increased wisdom is going to increase your anger. So if a person should be realistic. He hasn't seen a good friend for a while. And they get together and they join nice dinner and they talk about old times. That is a genuinely good thing. It feels good. It's in line with the Torah. I mean, even having the holidays, it's a command that you spend time with meat and wine and your family and your friends, and you don't learn the whole day. Shabbos is a day that's supposed to be 100% involved in wisdom. The holidays are supposed to be half and half. You're supposed to get up at sunrise and learn and pray until your prayer takes maybe like an hour and a half or something. You learn the rest of the time until midday, which is about 1 o'clock now. And then from that point, from 1 o'clock until 8 o'clock, which is sunset here in the East Coast, so then you're involved in drinking and eating and friends, taking a walk, doing things that are enjoyable, because it's a command to do this, because it's a good. So it's important that we look to the Torah, and we should make up our own. People don't try to be overly righteous, and they try to be very stern, and they think it's foolish for them to be expressive, and it takes away, it demeans their stature if they crack a joke with some friends in public. What's wrong with that? You're making your friends happy. Well, a lot of people like that. They get more of the ego is still overpowering them. They feel they have to come off a certain way. You see people like this. All right. He goes on. And he says, okay. Then he says further, and the matter of, you should remove anger from your heart. This means, and that's, again, this is another verse he's quoting, Ibn Ezra. So he says, this means that you should not let your ego rule over you. Because, again, it's because of ego that gives birth to anger. Anger, again, you have to see clearly, is an expression of when the ego was frustrated. So if you're seeking ego, then you're going to get anger. So therefore, he says, remove anger from your heart, which is a way of saying, start working on your arrogance and diminish it as far as you can. And he says also, there's another verse that says, you should remove evil from your flesh. And this is referring to the lusts. Because he says, if a person will eat all foods that he desires, he'll bring evil to himself on his flesh, on his body. And if he involves himself too much in sex, the same thing, he'll bring sickness to himself. And he says, when we talk about the flesh, we're talking about the body, meaning the sensual, the organs. And he goes on and he says, and behold, we have mentioned, it's been mentioned in this verse, again, he's referring to that verse he just quoted in Qoheleth, He doesn't have any notes here, so I can't tell you exactly where it is. But he says, it mentions in that verse, that when a person will weaken with all his abilities, his arrogance, that gives birth to anger, and also the soul, which goes after the soul of the flesh, meaning the lusts. That'll be a good thing. And he says another matter, another quote he's giving now. He says, quote, it is better. It is good to eat and to drink. So now how could King Solomon say that? It is good that a person, he says, Tov asher yafa le'echol, that the person eats and drinks. He says this is in accordance with the fool. And what type of fool? The fool that does the following. He gathers too much money. He's too much into the worth, you know, the work ethic. And he never takes time to enjoy any of it. So that's what, so you see, he's qualifying the verses. If he just, the rule is up to this point, if you just read the verse, it could be a problem. But if even as a show you have to qualify who is the verse talking about. When it says that a person should eat and drink, didn't we just say eating and drinking is going to aggravate the taivas, the lusts? If you aggravate the lusts, that's not a good thing. So how could King Solomon say eat and drink? So he said this is a response to the people who are miserly and they never spend a penny on themselves. They should eat and drink. They should enjoy themselves a little bit. Don't go overboard, but don't be the other extreme, he's saying. Okay? So you have to see how the verses have to be qualified. Okay, and then he says, then there's another verse, and he says, it's better that a person goes to the house of mourning. So, what does that mean? So this, Ibn Ezra says, this is an absolute truth. This verse does not need any qualification. So he's training you over here how to go through, and this should be applied to all areas of Torah. Now, when you read something, it's not just the written word. That's why we have an oral law, too. You can't just read. That's what the Sadducees did. They just took the written law, and they dismissed the oral law, and they came up with preposterous notions. So every single verse that King Solomon is talking about over here, he says, you have to understand, who is it talking about? When is it talking? When is it to be applied? And he goes on. He says, V'inyan, another matter that I talked about here, that Ibn Ezra is saying that King Solomon talked about. Quote, what is there more to the wise man that if he becomes wise, like the actions of a fool, that he does not satisfy his soul? So what benefit is there to him? So now he says, it sounds again like a problem. There's a verse that says, what more is there to a wise person? Well, what do you mean? That should be obvious. Wisdom is the best life. But he's saying here, and this one I'm not really clear about what his point is, but he says that the person increases in his wisdom like a fool, and he does not satisfy his soul. Meaning to say, if he's going, it seems to be he's just going through the motions. Certain people you have today where they just want to cover ground and this becomes the whole goal, but they're not enjoying it. But they have this ego thing, I got to cover a certain amount of ground in my Torah studies, and that is what keeps them motivated. But he says, this is not satisfying the soul, so what good is that? He's just using the amount of his studies as a for the ego again. But then he says another verse he quotes, where it says there is a great benefit to wisdom. That verse, he says, is true. That's an absolute truth again. That one does not need qualification. Okay, and then he gives another verse. He says, V'chein, and also there's another verse, and I praised happiness. Because those who weary themselves in this world and they don't seek out wisdom that really give happiness, they are more praiseworthy than those who worry about mourning. So there he's not saying that, again, what he says, and he praised, and I praised happiness. Ibn Ezra now has quoted another verse in Qohelet, and he says, quote, and I praised happiness for those who weary themselves in the world, and they don't acquire wisdom that really gives happiness, nonetheless, they're still better off than those who mourn over those who mourn. They worry about negativity. So what does he mean? This one I think I'm going to leave open because I'm not 100% on this. We haven't done that verse yet, so maybe we'll do it when we get up to it. Okay. Maybe we'll stop here and let's see if there's any questions or comments. We said we recorded a number of verses. Well, let me just hear from you if there's any questions or comments.
None here.
Okay. But you see the rule that we're coming away with. The rule we're coming away with is that we have to qualify the verse. And we can't just read the verse and take it on face value, because there's meaning here, and there's a method for applying it. That's why Ibn Ezra is so lengthy over here, to show you when and where. Who is it talking about? Is this verse an absolutely true verse, or is it a verse, like for example, he says, let me read you one more. There's something which I've been repeating over to you many, many times, and he says it openly here. Let me just read it to you. He says, the matter where it says in the verse, a living dog is better than a dead lion. So typically you think a lion is better than a dog. No, that's, we'll have to understand why is that not true. What's the notion that a person would think that, even if a person is considered a lion, or actually saying not a person, but he's saying an actual lion is always better than a dog, but he says no, not if the lion is dead. So in that case, a live dog is better than a dead lion. And on this, he says this is the words of man, meaning to say he's vocalizing the opinions of people. That, and he's saying that that's a wrong notion. So a lot of times he'll say something, and he's just trying to bring out. And I've mentioned this to you a number of times, that King Solomon will describe a phenomenon and give a value to it, but that's not, that he'll only say that because he wants other people to hear it and say, yeah, that's how I feel. But he'll break it down in the next verse, or in the same verse. But his method of educating is to bring to the fore those notions, those unspoken ideas that people have that are wrong. And the only way to actually get them, people to listen to a different angle on it, is to first speak about it as if it's him saying it. Now he's caught the ear, but then he breaks it down. And that's what Ibn Ezra is saying over here. He will make statements, and King Solomon is recording them as if it's his own, but then he shows you, no, it's not his. This is the words, he's quoting people. So Ibn Ezra is qualifying that statement. So the person says, "Kilef Kelev Chai, Hu Tov." It's better to be a living dog than to be a dead lion. So there would seem to be, what's the problem that people have? They're looking at life as being better, as being the only good. So as long as I'm alive, it's better. That's not true. Who says that the person's dismissing the next world? Okay, so he goes on. He's almost done. There's just a few more sentences. But we'll go through those next week, and we'll see how he shows them. It's a very good lesson, showing how each one of these verses has different ways to understand it, and who is it applying to. That's really what's important to see here. Sometimes he's vocalizing a truth. Sometimes he's vocalizing something which is just a preferred state, but not an absolutely good. Like, you know, B is better than A, but that doesn't mean that B is better than C. It just means that if you had B and A in front of you, B would be better. So he's giving a certain lesson. Or we talked about, you know, like we said before, how could he tell us that going after the physical pleasures is no good? And then he says that a person is a fool if he doesn't enjoy his pleasures. Because there he's talking about a person who never involves himself at all in pleasures. So that type of person has to have a certain amount of pleasure. You have to tell that person to go after it a bit. Each person has a different nature or a different way to accustom themselves, and they're making errors. So they're going to need a different remedy. A person who's involved in wisdom so much, that person, you don't tell him to stop his enjoyment of wisdom and to sit down and have a steak. He's already in the higher levels, and he really values it for what it is. So he'll have the right attitude, but he needs to eat, he will. But to get the right equilibrium in a person who's too miserly, like the Rambam says, my mind is, you go to the other extreme. To get yourself out of that miserly state, you become like a spendthrift until you balance out in the middle. If a person is never enjoying himself whatsoever in any physical pleasures, so then he has to go to the other extreme and engage in a lot of physical pleasures until he balances out in the middle. So when he says that a person should be involved, in one case he ridicules the lusts. In another case, he phrases it, it depends on who you're talking about. Of course, he's never saying to break any Torah law. But it's saying a person has to have a certain equilibrium. And that is going to be achieved for different people depending on what the starting point is. All right? So think it over. And you'll see how it makes sense now when you read more verses. You'll be able to say, oh, when does this apply now? So if you want, maybe a good exercise for this week, read further. Go through, you know, the rest of chapter 7 and see what he says, and maybe see how you can apply his rule now. And what's his basic rule? You give each part of the three portions, the three faculties in man, its due when it's proper. You don't totally squelch lusts. You don't totally squelch out the ego. There's a time where you have to stand for something, or there's a time where you have to display yourself as angry, or as in order to teach a child something, right? But of course, predominantly, the majority of the time is we're involved in wisdom. And to that point, that wisdom is always supposed to be what is ruling every part of our actions. I mean, that's always going to be present. So this past week's Parsha, we read about at the very end of Midbar, it talks about when they disassembled the tabernacle and they traveled in the desert because they traveled 40 years. So they didn't always stay in one spot. They moved. Sometimes they stayed at an encampment for a day or 2 days or a week or a month. Or there was one encampment. They were there for 18 years. But they did move. So when they broke down the tabernacle, so the Aaron and his sons were commanded to put coverings on all the vessels, the ark, the candelabrum, the table with the showbread, and the gold altar for the incense, and the altar that was used for animal sacrifices. So every one of these things had two covers. It had a cloth covering of a certain color, and it had an animal skin covering, which was to protect it, of course, from the elements. But the question comes up why you had the cloth covering. But what's very interesting is that on all the vessels, except for the ark, the animal skin covering was on the outside. The ark, however, you put the animal skin covering on, and then you put the blue cloth on the outside. Why is that? And what the rabbis speak about why blue. So blue, they refer to as being the essence of the heavens, the purity of the heavens, which King David referred to in Psalms, and he says when he looks at the heavens, the work of your fingers, I think, what is man that you should be mindful of him? Well, the son of man, that you should remember him. Meaning, King David was overcome by the God's creations as expressed in the heavens. So the blue of the sky, of the heavens, is to represent the Creator. So what is this concept that on all the vessels, they would cover them with the animal skins on the outside as protective from the elements, except for the ark? That one had the blue on the outside. So what was inside the ark? Inside the ark was the Torah. It was the Ten Commandments and the Torah. So what I believe the lesson is that even when the tabernacle is not assembled, so maybe all the other vessels have lose their purpose because now they're sort of in storage, so to speak, until they get to the new location. But there's one vessel which is always in use, in the ark. The ark didn't find any higher purpose when it was sitting in the temple or when it was not. And because of that, you never remove the poles from the ark. When you put all the other vessels into the tabernacle, once they were in their right location, you'd slide out the poles that were used for carrying, because now they were in the temple, now we're in the tabernacle. And now they found their designation, they found their purpose only as conforming to the structure of tabernacle, except for one thing, the ark. And there was a law in the Torah that says you never remove the poles from the ark. That's to show you that the ark does not find any greater purpose in the temple, outside the temple, because the temple is not the focal point. The ark is the focal point, because Torah, the ideas, is something which is the essence of life. So you can't put the ark into a building and not pull out the poles. That would indicate that now the ark has found a greater purpose when it's in this building as opposed to when it's not in the building. That's not true. So therefore, you never remove the poles to show that it didn't find any greater purpose, because wisdom is the purpose, and that's what the ark is essentially. So you don't take the poles out. There's no need to. You do not demonstrate that it's finding a greater purpose. Therefore, when they traveled, although all the other vessels were covered with skins, the ark was not. It had to have the blue covering on the outside to remind the people of the heavens that God created, and to remind them that wisdom is something which is never dormant. It's true, the other vessels, they had other purposes only when the structure of the tabernacle was rebuilt, when they got to a new location. But that's only all the other vessels except for the ark. The ark was an independent concept. All right? So you see, it's basically what we're saying over here. Wisdom has always got to be what a person operates on. That's never dormant, and all the other parts of the person's psyche, his arrogance, his ego, his lusts, all these different things, they should be gauged and given the right portion, like Ibn Ezra says, but in line with what the intelligence tells us. Okay. All right, so I guess with that, we'll wrap it up, and we'll pick up from here in the Ibn Ezra, and we'll finish the Ibn Ezra next Sunday. All right? Any questions?
I think we're good here. Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay. All right, so
Rabbi, good. Thank you for that last point. That is fantastic.
Oh, thank you very much.
Look provoking and very inspiring.
Thanks. All right, so good week to everybody. Thank you so much.